session number 21564, reel 18.
Colonel Cormac, reel 18. You were saying that you were waved down by a Vopo.
That's
car.
Right. He made the great mistake of letting me stay where I was on the side of the road, and he was on the other side pointing the other way. Quite a wide road. And it suddenly occurred to me there was a lot of traffic going past in both directions. And the East Germans had a great passion for trucks and trailers, big trucks and big trailers, and mostly agricultural produce or that sort of thing around. And I thought to myself, now this is a silly thing. He's on the wrong side of the road. He should have blocked me off. But we had, I said to my driver, the next time a truck and trailer come past and blocks us off from him, switch the engine on so there's no sudden noise and tick over quietly. And then we'll see if that has disturbed them. If nothing happens, then the next truck and trailer comes past, we'll tick off and he'll be blocked and can't turn around quickly. And that's just what we did. And shot off into the distance, and we got away.
On what grounds would he have been able to detain you?
Oh, presumably some traffic violation or the usual thing, or I'd been taking photographs, or I mean they would do it often without good reason.
Yes.
Just to annoy you and just to hold you up. And the commandants were generally pretty shrewd. They could tell that you had just been mucked around. I suppose, to something serious, and then you would have a token detention. But it would all take time, particularly if the commandant was some way away. And then we dashed off and off the main roads into the woods and got away.
You were saying that when you were on tour, you'd be out for several days, that you didn't stay in hotels. What sort of camping equipment did you have for...
We had very, very good. We had the usual officer's kit roll thing. That was... And then I would have a sleeping bag, which I used inside the roll. I took my own shaving and washing kit, should I need that, and so on. And we took our own food, and we had a little gas burner or petrol stove to heat up food if you wanted a hot meal. That was all possible. But the sleeping bags were really very, very good. I've still got mine. And we occasionally tested out special ones. The Himalayan expedition wanted us to try something, and we had these enormous things. That was the only two-piece one I had. Trousers that came up to here and the top that came down to there. And you looked like a Michelin man when you were dressed up. But the standard sleeping bags were perfectly adequate. Even in the winter, when the temperature did get rather low in middle Europe. And it was still, I thought, better. I always slept out. The driver and the tour NCO more often than not slept in the car. No real fug up there. But I preferred that, however cold it was. And I think I felt fresher after it than a night in a car.
How many nights out would you be normally?
Well, mostly it was just one night. I mean, you had a local tour, which would be 6 to 8 hours. And then you would have a day tour. Then it would be an overnight tour, one night or two nights, depending on how far down you were going and so on. Very occasionally longer. And then you had to make sure you had enough food for that.
How far to the east could you get if you set off on a prolonged tour? Could you get right over to the Polish border area?
No, you got to the border area, and then you hit the border PRA. I've got a PRA map, if you want to have a look at that, just to give you a feel for what I was saying. But there were great chunks all round the edge, were pretty well PRAs, except the gap at Helmstedt to get you through that way. And the Americans used the Route 5 to Hamburg. They had an exit that way, I think. And then there was another one down south. And then there were the trains. The British military train went out through Helmstedt. The American military train went down towards Frankfurt. But that was the only way you could get through the borders. And great chunks of the middle country were all in PRAs too, according to what sort of training went on and what sort of equipment and units were stationed there. Missile equipment units and their equipment were usually in PRAs. some SAM sites, that's the surface to air missile sites, were not, but they were very well protected and fenced off from a long ways out with plenty of wooded cover. So they didn't necessarily have to be in a PRA. And of course, that would give things away too much if the PRAs, you would hover around the outside. Then occasionally they would have a goose egg, which is a TRA, and that's just a line, and a temporary one for an exercise. And then CERB would issue us with the goose egg and say that it starts from 0900 hours and such and such a day and will finish, etc. And that was to stop us going into an area between two PRAs or where a major exercise was taking place. And the only route through a TRA was on an autobahn. They were generally not closed to us, but you couldn't always see very much from an autobahn.
Presumably that would give you notice of somewhere to go and try and look, wouldn't it?
Yes, you would prowl around the outside and hope you would see something moving in or moving out. Occasionally, you could be very lucky and you could be out on tour in an area when a goose egg was declared.
So you wouldn't have knowledge of it.
You would not, hand and heart, have any idea of that, and there you were. And sometimes you saw most enormous columns of kit and units moving all over the place, and that could be great fun. But that was a matter of chance that you happened to be out at the time.
How did they normally react if they detected you observing them, the people in these columns moving about?
Some of them just got angry and waved at you. Some, if they had a chance, depending on which way you were going, against the flow or with the flow, or would try and knock you off the road. That didn't happen very often, but it did occasionally happen. Or they would simply, some vehicle come out and chase you. And then you had to make off at high speed. Mm. And then when the columns are moving, they had a system of tactical signs, usually off the roads and cross country. And on the main roads, they had traffic regulators. And they were guys who went out in motorbikes and sidecars, and they were dropped off, and they had these batons. Later on, they got smarter and more sophisticated, and they had lit-up batons for night and that sort of thing. Mm. And they would be directing the columns. And they would try and stop you following a column. Sometimes it was prudent to turn off. Sometimes it was worth it to follow the column a bit further and see what you could see, because they tended to move in tactical formation. So by recording the vehicles in order of march, it provided clues as to how the unit was organized. So that was always worth doing. But you could use simple tricks to fool them, and the simpler the trick, the better. Mm. And I was following one column, and it came to a T-junction, and I was driving along, and I got past it, and I saw a lot of traffic moving that way, and there was a regulator there. So I said to my driver, go up and indicate a left turn.
Yes.
When you get to the T-junction, immediately turn right. Mm. Because if you tell someone you're going to turn left, they believe you.
They think you're going to.
They're going to. You indicate. So what else would you be doing? Mm. And that basic sort of trick was much more than anything more complicated. Mm. And then you could just spin off the right and follow the column up and hope you got away with it. But sometimes you did. But that was why it was so interesting, and there was excitement and considerable amount of fun out of it, and a certain amount of risk, but and the whole thing you felt was very much worthwhile. You were doing something useful. The input from the mission was very significant, indeed.
Did you get any help or assistance from the civil population of East Germany at any stage?
Not really. They did like to talk, stop and chat. And oddly enough, in view of the fact that I'd done a Russian language course before I went to Brixmas, it would in many ways have been possibly more helpful if I had fluent German. And then, because talking to people, you would ask them, and you could see on the cobblestones the track marks of tanks. So you would be able to, you would occasionally stop and ask the local people, have the Panzers been this way? Have the tanks been this way? And they would sometimes say, yes, they've gone up, and they might help you like that, but they were more often than not, they would stop and say, when are we going to be free? When are you going to save us from this terrible regime? That did happen quite a bit. Mm. And then you did pick up little bits of the way they were regulated by going to certain schools and directed to certain jobs, no freedom of choice, only real party members getting to higher education. These little things all filtered in. Mm. And you picked up a picture there. They would only do that out in the country when they were sure they would not be seen by people who would report them.
Nobody looking at them.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any chance of informal chats with Russians?
Only in commandanturas, really.
Not in the field?
No. Mm. I can remember one. I was up in the north, and I'd been detained, and there was a chap there, and he had his hand in his pockets, and he was leaning against the wall, practically sitting on the radiator. So I observed that it was fairly cold. Yes, and it turned out he'd come from the south. He'd come from the Crimea area. And he hated this damp, cold north, and he was longing for the warm, sunny south. That was a very rare example of a casual conversation that I could relate to. Mostly it was very formal. Sometimes friendly. I think you had a recording of the story when I was detained by the border guard, and the commandant turned up, and the East Germans were sure I was going to get into fearful trouble, and he came up and threw his arms around my neck and gave me a great hug and said, "Ah, Gospodin, now you're in trouble again." It was quite joyful, really.
What about your relations with the Serb? Did you develop any sort of warmth with them, or was it always on a very correct and formal basis?
It varied very much as the intensity or otherwise of the Cold War. If the governments at top level were pretty frosty with each other, then our relations with Serb were frosty. Mm. If there was a slight thaw in relations, it worked its way down. Mm. They were responsible for giving us our rations. We had token rations from the Soviets delivered through Serb to the mission, which then came to our house. Of course, they were totally inadequate to keep us. We lived on British rations. Mm. But it was nice to have bread, some very nice meat sometimes, jars of cherries, pickled gherkins, all the absolutely essentials of life. Mm. We got a token ration from them. We used to give them a certain amount of whiskey at Christmas time. And occasionally they would come to private or unofficial parties in the mission house, and very rarely to the chief's house in Berlin. But they would come. And some were really jolly and friendly, some were very reserved. It was interesting to see. But overall, relations were a bit distant. When Colonel Pinchuk was the head of Serb when I was leaving, he sent me a small jar of caviar with the message through my chief, Brigadier David Wilson, that he wished me well on my journey home and he never wanted to see me again. And that was a human touch. I thought that was nice.
When you were out in the field observing the East German forces and the Russian forces, how would you compare the characteristics of the two, the Russian armed forces on the ground and the East German?
The East Germans, I think, felt that they were overall more professional, better trained, and, as they thought, better motivated in many ways than the Soviet forces, who were far from their homeland in a country of which they knew nothing and were not allowed to know very much. I think they felt that, and their equipment gradually got better and better, and they resented us much more than the Soviets did, because after all, our treaty, our agreement, the Robertson-Malin agreement, setting up the missions, was between us and the Soviets and not these Germans. And they were very conscious of their subservient status, and they always wanted to be able to operate independently and act without constantly consulting the Soviets. You felt that all the way through. They were much more inclined to be violent with us than the Soviets, although both were, but most of that would come from the East German army. They would be much more aggressive in many ways. When it came to putting up mission signs, the original signs were all put up by the Soviet forces. And then the East Germans, when they got more organized and with their own barracks and training, were then allowed to put up mission signs. And they were very efficient at that. And they were very well set. I mean, you couldn't knock out a German mission sign over without a tank, basically, nearly. Whereas the Soviet signs occasionally rotted and fell into ditches. You know, the wood had rotted away or whatever, and they had fallen into a ditch, and you couldn't see them. And they tended not to be so permanent. But the East Germans, with their typical efficiency, made sure they were firmly based in concrete or metal posts, whatever. Little things like that gave you an indication of the difference.
They're more thorough.
And they were not warm to it at all. You know.
Were you ever able to observe the East German army in action, as it were, on exercises? And
it was very difficult to see anybody on exercise, apart from moving to an exercise area, because they were so carefully excluded by these temporary restricted areas or permanent restricted areas. You could learn a lot from following up behind as to who they were, but it was difficult to see them moving in what I would call tactical formation. And occasionally, some of the bigger areas, which were on the fringe of a restricted area, you could get a viewpoint and see them moving with, say, a troop of three or four tanks going and the infantry on foot beside or behind, or in APCs, and then dismounting at a certain point. But your glimpses of that sort of thing were few and far between.
When you did see that sort of thing, I mean, presumably you got similar glimpses of the Russians doing the same sort
yes.
of thing.
That's right. They were very much the same. And clearly they were both running to a similar doctrine. And the idea of the whole thing was that if the Soviet army moved west and hit the Rhine in 3 days, or whatever their target was, that they would be fully supported by the East German army, who would be a very effective second echelon or whatever. And so their tactics and equipment tended to match. They had to be effective. But with those differences I highlighted. In the end, of course, when the war, when the whole thing crumbled, and the regime in East Germany fell, the war came down, it became clear that the East German army was not quite as committed to moving west with the Soviets as at first thought.
How did that become apparent?
Because they could easily have stopped the whole thing. I mean, the Stasi, for example, had the equivalent of an armored division at their private beck and call. And in spite of all the riots in Leipzig and Dresden and East Berlin, if they had been really serious about it, they could have stopped the whole thing by force. But it didn't happen.
One stage, there was a theory that in the event of a move westwards by the Warsaw Pact, what the Russians would do would be to ensure that the East German army were in the first echelon, so that they, the Russians, could then hold the population of East Germany as hostage for the good behaviour of the East German army. Do you remember that ever being
I'm not sure that that was the case. Mm. Certainly in the 1960s, and even when I was in BOR later on, the prime threat was the Soviet army. Mm. And all our tactics and the great GDP plans, which changed every 2 or 3 years as the commanders-in-chief changed, that was how you make a mark, of course, all indicated that the first troops that we would meet would be the Soviet army. And indeed, that bore out our feeling was that the barracks in northwest of Potsdam, northwest of Berlin, in the old Olympic Village from 1936, 19th Motor Rifle Division, was the spearhead division which would lead the way down the Autobahn and crash straight through.
It's part of the Soviet Third Shock, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, the Shock Army.
Yes.
Things may have changed a bit, but I would have felt that the East German Army would have played a secondary role, I think. And in the end, of course, they just didn't do what people thought they would do. Sort of digressing very slightly, in the late 80s and 1990, when the wall came down, the Soviet army were in a state of shock. They could not really understand how, with 350,000 troops well organized into armies, corps, and so on, divisions, failed to hold the country in complete check. And also, I think they were equally surprised at the lack of effort on the East German army, how it just did nothing. And even the Stasi division, which one would have thought would have commanded implicit loyalty to the regime, didn't intervene. These are questions that others are better qualified to answer, but that's what we were surprised at.
Did you have any hint of that sort of thing might happen one day in the distant future?
No,
when you were
not when I was there. Mm. No, I didn't.
You mentioned that sometimes you made visits to Soviet formations and units as part of Bricksmiths. You said they were very formal visits.
No, well, they were very few and far between. Mm. They were mostly accidental. The main visits were to Serb and to
yes.
the headquarters of the group of Soviet forces in Germany. There were two or three occasions at intervals when, in response to possibly a thaw in East-West relations, a token return of Soviet troops to the Soviet Union were arranged as showpieces, and mission members and attaches would be invited to come down and see them getting into trains and allegedly driving back to Russia. But they didn't happen very often.
Was there anything you could learn from observing them on those occasions? Was there useful information to be gleaned from that sort of visit?
Only that they would, on occasion, put on a propaganda show to react to Western opinion. But my own feeling was that those gestures were token gestures and not real ones, and that they also saw the value of making such a gesture, but without actually going to carry it through properly. That was my feeling at that time, and possibly since. Yeah.
Did you get an impression of the physical condition of the Soviet and East German troops?
It's quite an interesting one, that. One had the feeling that although both armies were conscript armies, that the basic German, East German army soldier, and I must say East German army soldier, was of overall better intelligence and better trained than his Soviet equivalent. I think the Soviet officers at higher unit levels in regiments or battalions, regiments and divisions were very efficient and very well trained and very competent, but the soldiers, by virtue of the very Soviet system, were not so effective because they simply did as they were told and they didn't have all that much idea where they were. They had some idea that they were where they were to preserve the system, but if you see it, they didn't really appreciate that they were in the borders of Western Europe. I don't. That was my feeling. They were also, this is the mid-1960s, they're sort of very scruffy. They had poor uniforms, and their personal equipment and personal lives were very much below standard. They just didn't have a chance to go out and meet anybody. They weren't allowed to. Very restricted life in the barracks, except out and exercise. Various restricted outings. They were just there to do a job for the conscript service and then back again. The officers had a little more flexibility, but not much. You didn't see them around shopping to any great extent or mixing with the local population as we did in BOR. After war was over, they just didn't seem to do that. So it was a curious mixture. And yet it did change. I mean, later on, 1980s, we had the 40th anniversary of the formation of Brixmas. And by that time, I had, with some assistance, established the Brixmas Association and had permission for it to exist. We all went out to Berlin for a tremendous party. And the one thing I did notice is when we crossed the Glienicke Bridge, we were in buses. There was where's the Soviet sentry in his shapeless overalls or denims, if you like, and his boots would shuffle out of his thing and grab your papers and look at them in a sort of bewildered sort of way and then let you go through. There was a guard of honor on the bridge, very smartly dressed, down to the soldiers. They were really smart, and big salutes as we came past. There was a major difference in their turnout and bearing at that time. And that was quite impressive. It didn't in the end help them very much when it came to the collapse of the system. But that was an indication that things were improving and changing, that the lot of the soldier was improving. And I hope it was just more than an impression, but that was something that struck us at that particular time. And we met a few Soviet officers and their wives at the reception in the mission house. It was a very nice occasion. And they were much more chatty than they had been. Curious, I wouldn't like to say any more, but that was certainly an impression that things had improved. But the East Germans were completely excluded from all that. They just did not, they were not seen. It was nothing to do with them. It was a celebration of the anniversary of the agreement between Robertson and Malinin. So why should they? But I've no doubt they were observing and filming. But that was a good party. We had planned to have a 50th one. But unfortunately, the wall came down and the mission was closed before that happened.
Who decided where you went when you went on tour? Was this done by the ops officer or by a higher level authority? Or was it partly a matter of the higher command or partly a matter of your own ideas of what should happen?
It was
next?
Part of the tasking that I remember the team from BOR used to come up twice a year. And they would give their requirements to the mission. And the ops officer, after discussing it with the G1 and the chief and the RAF, would then hoist all these points aboard, and then he would task us for each tour. And so, directly or indirectly, it came from the requirements of Rheindalen, and they, in turn, were no doubt bombarded by requests from MOD London for information on this, that, and the other thing. So it came all the way down, but it was the BOR team that translated the requirements for us and gave us the target lists and the requirements in detail.
Do you remember if there were any major shifts of emphasis during your time there?
No, not in the middle 1960s. There's no doubt that over the years the approach changed a bit, and that would reflect the attitude between the East and West. More confidence in the East, in the West, because don't forget, by the end of the 1950s, people were writing books, "Are the Russians 10 feet tall?" There was almost a feeling that they were a superhuman army that could sweep through to the channel without